Copper and Brass Incorporated. Founded by Paul Revere in 1801. Fabricators of copper, copper alloys, and aluminum alloys for home and industry. And makers of the famous Revere ware presents Meet the Press.
Our guest of the afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, will be Congressman John F. Kennedy of Boston, son of the former ambassador to England. Mr. Kennedy has recently returned from an extensive trip to the Middle and Far East. Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air. Ready for this afternoon's unrehearsed spontaneous press conference are four of America's top reporters. Please remember that their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It's their way of getting a story for you. But first, here is the moderator of the Meet the Press panel, Miss Martha Roundtree.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another session of Meet the Press. You've met our guest, Congressman Kennedy. Now meet the press. First, Mr. Ernest Lindley of Newsweek magazine. Next, Mrs. May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald. Mr. James Reston of the New York Times. Mr. Lawrence Spivak, editor and publisher and regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Congressman Kennedy, if you are ready, I think we will let Mrs. Craig have the first question.
Congressman, aren't you worried about the revelations of communism and corruption in the executive departments?
Well, I'm certainly worried by the revelation of corruption in the executive department. I think that the stories of communism within the executive branch of the government have more or less died out, and I think that determined efforts have been made to rid the executive branch of the government of the communists, and I think it's been done on the whole. But I think we have a long way to go, as these recent disclosures tell us, to rid the government of the small group of men who take advantage of their office.
Well, Mr. Congressman, don't you think it would have been better if the president had taken the lead in cleaning up in these two very bad fields than waiting to be overwhelmed as at present?
Well, I think he's best fulfilled in the best position to say what his responsibilities are in the matter. I think that he should take a vigorous stand, and I think that he is understanding that, and I think he's beginning to. Whether he waited too long or not is a matter of opinion. I think he did. I think perhaps he should have taken the leadership.
Well, sir, don't you think that it rather leaves the Democratic Party in a bad fix to go to the people now and ask re-election? Would you blame the voters if they thought it needs a change of party in the White House in order to clean up?
Well, I don't think that the Democratic Party should win an election unless it does clean up. If it doesn't do it, then I don't think we deserve to win the election. I think that efforts are being made to clean it up, but unless we're successful, then I think that we should lose the election.
Mr. Lindley.
Mr. Kennedy, who, in your opinion, would make the strongest Democratic nominee for the presidency next year?
Well, as I've only heard of one or two men discussed, and as it seems fairly inevitable that if President Truman is a candidate for re-election, he will receive the nomination, I would say that he would be probably the strongest. Now, there's been some talk of General Eisenhower running. I don't know whether General Eisenhower is a Republican or a Democrat, and therefore I would say under the present situation that probably President Truman would be the strongest Democratic candidate, as he has led the party for the last few years.
But do you really think he would be the strongest candidate?
Well, you would have to suggest who you might the field, but of those who have been mentioned, I think that probably he would be the strongest candidate. Unless General Eisenhower ran as a Democrat and supported the Democratic program, then he might be a strong candidate.
You really think that General Eisenhower might accept the Democratic nomination?
I've seen no indication. I don't know whether he's a Democrat or a Republican, but as I say, if he supported the Democratic program and felt he could, then I think he probably would be a strong candidate. But perhaps you could give me some choices, and I'll tell you whether I thought President Truman
All right, Chief Justice Vinson.
Well, I think probably Mr. Truman would probably be a stronger candidate than Mr. Vinson.
Senator Kefauver of Tennessee.
I think Senator Kefauver would be a strong candidate. I think it's difficult to say. I wouldn't be in a position to say who would be the strong between Senator Kefauver and I personally like Senator Douglas, but he's announced that he is not going to be a candidate. But as Senator Kefauver has not announced, and everyone admits that President Truman could get the nomination if he wants to, it's more or less of an academic issue.
But Senator Lodge of your state says that General Eisenhower is a Republican, period. You are not convinced that Senator Lodge is fully informed on that point.
He may be, but he has not disclosed the source of his information, and I really don't know, and I don't think anyone's in a position to say and disclose the reasons why General Eisenhower may be either a Republican or Democrat. All you can say is he's a Republican, period, but that's certainly not satisfactory.
You're not convinced that he is a Republican, though, are you?
I have no reason to be convinced he's a Republican or a Democrat, as he's ignored politics for a long time, quite rightly, in his military career. But there are those who say they know, and in view of that, perhaps we can accept their opinion.
Well, if General Eisenhower should be the Republican nominee, do you know of any Democrat who could defeat him?
Well, I think that the Democratic Party could make a very good showing, and I think would have every chance to win, providing we clean house and providing the world's at peace. I think the Democratic Party perhaps could win. Once General Eisenhower takes off his uniform, leaves a very critical situation in Western Europe, and takes a position on issues like civil rights and labor legislation, etc., and becomes a candidate and runs for office, I think we'd get a better idea of whether he is going to be able to sweep the country or not.
Well, if General Eisenhower were the Democratic nominee, do you think any Republican could defeat him?
Well, once General Eisenhower took the took a position on civil rights and labor legislation and endorsed the Democratic program, then I think that perhaps he would be weakened. Regardless of what side he takes, he's going to be weaker than he is today. He's stronger as a figure in Western Europe as a commander of troops there trying to do a job than he will be when he endorses one side or the other. I think that's the difficulty of politics. You are always bound to lose supporters once you take a stand on an issue, and I think that this General Eisenhower will have that experience. Whether he'll lose enough to affect his chances or not, I think would be difficult to predict at this time.
Do you think he will have Europe in such condition that he can afford to leave to run for the presidency if he wants to?
Well, I think that we're going to be in the most critical time in Western Europe that we're ever going to be about next March or next spring. General Eisenhower has been attempting to build sufficient divisions to protect that area from attack by land, but the best indication is that by that time he's only going to have around 26 or 27 or perhaps 28 divisions by next spring, providing the Germans come in to some degree. Certainly not enough to stand up against the 175 divisions that the Russians are supposed to have under arms. Certainly not enough to protect Western Europe. And whether he feels that it's going to be in any kind of shape or whether he feels that he's gotten it over the roughest part, I don't know. That's a decision for him. But I certainly feel that we're going to be in the most danger of war in the summer of 1952, and therefore it's a question to me whether he can afford to leave it, but that's a decision that he will have to make.
Mr. Spivak.
Congressman, you said a moment that you thought that the Democrats should lose if they don't clean house. Don't you think that a great deal of responsibility for the mess that we've been in belongs to the Democratic Party?
Well,
and
we
that
have
the voters will punish them for it, or should punish them for it?
Well, I would say that the Democratic Party has the responsibility as they are now in control. On the other hand, I think it's a comparatively small group of men. I think that people like Senator Kefauver and Congressman King and others, Senator Fulbright and others, and Senator Douglas have attempted to set a clear pattern for us in our attitude towards this corruption, and I think that the Democrats in the House and Senate are taking a leadership in trying to rid the executive branch of the government of it, and I think that the people will be impressed by that, and providing they do the job, and we all do the job, then I think that we have a right to go to the people and hope for some success.
But have they always done that without opposition from the executive branch? Take the case of Fulbright, for example. When he first started on his investigation of the RFC, he didn't get very full cooperation from the White House, did he?
Well, I read in the papers there was some indication that perhaps at the beginning he didn't, but I'm sure that President Truman is as interested as all of us are in ridding the government of corruption, and I'm sure he's very anxious to do it.
Do you think President Truman can carry Massachusetts if he gets the nomination again?
Providing we're not in a war, providing we have rid the government, the executive branch, and all parts of the government of corruption, I think that President Truman, if he is the Democratic nominee and nominated by the party, has a good chance to take Massachusetts. He took it before. The Democratic Party has carried Massachusetts now in every presidential election since 1932, and I think Massachusetts is basically a Democratic state, and I think if we do our job and do it right, I think that we have a good chance to carry Massachusetts in 1952.
Now, Mr. Kennedy, when I was in Boston last week, I heard a good deal of talk about you. There are many who thought that you would be the Democratic nominee for the senatorship against Henry Cabot Lodge. Are you going to run?
Well, I'd like to go to the Senate. I'm definitely interested in it. I think most of those of us in the House who came in after the war, some of them have already gone to the Senate, like George Smathers and Nixon and others, and I'm definitely interested in going to the Senate. And I'm seriously considering running. I'm not sure yet what exactly I'm going to do. It's still a year away, but I'm definitely interested in it, and I'm, as I say, seriously considering running, and I should really come to a final decision after the first of the year.
I'd like to come down to your trip in the Far East.
Before you change the subject, Mr. Spivak, I think Mr. Reston wanted to get, and then I'll come back to you.
You want to get into local politics?
Yes, I'd like to ask Congressman Kennedy a question. I wonder, sir, in the early days, when the signs of corruption first came, were brought to the attention of the public, what action did the young members of Congress in your party take to bring the point of view that you are now expressing to the attention of the White House? Was there any effort down in the House to urge the president to clean house 18 months ago or even before?
Well, I don't think that probably there was a concerted effort. I think that most of these disclosures of corruption came as the result of senatorial investigations, and I think that many individual members were in support of those efforts. Whether it there were any attempts made to persuade the president to take the leadership, I don't know.
Does your mail indicate that there is a widespread revulsion in this country to the disclosures of corruption within the government, or does it show some indifference on the part of the electorate?
No, I think they're definitely interested in it, and I think that they are, after all, when they are paying so heavily to maintain this government, they like to feel that they're getting an honest dollar's worth out of their hard-earned taxes, and therefore I think that they are revolted, and there's every indication of it, and I think the feeling is general.
Could I ask Barry just one more question
before
you go into the Far Eastern question? In talking about who would be the Democratic nominee in 1952, you seem to imply that the people down in the House were merely waiting for the president to make up his mind. Is there no movement within the Congress to try to make him make up his mind, either to run or indicate whom he would like to have succeed him as the Democratic nominee?
No, I don't think there has been any movement. I think it's been taken for granted that if President Truman was a candidate for re-election, he could probably win the nomination. There's been no indication of any other candidate running against him. There's been no prominent Democrat that's announced for the presidency, and therefore there's every indication that if President Truman desires the nomination, he can have it. And,
well, doesn't that make the element of accident in a great decision like that pretty high?
In what sense, Mr.
In the sense that we are merely apparently just waiting until one or two men make up their mind to let us know whether or not in June of 1952 they will be candidates or not.
Well, I agree. On the other hand, if there is no candidate for the office, and there is no announced Democratic candidate for the office, neither Senator Kefauver, who was mentioned, has announced that he's a candidate, or Senator Douglas, or Senator Fulbright, or Governor Stevenson of Illinois, many other very able Democrats, as they haven't announced for the office, nor has President Truman. It's rather difficult to decide exactly what the younger members of the House, who you mentioned, what they should do. I think that, and as it seems to be generally conceded, that by everyone, including the press, that if President Truman wants it, he can have it. I don't know whether we have a great decision to make or even a choice.
Now, Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Kennedy, you've just come back from the Far East and the Middle East. We've spent billions of dollars there in trying to save.
Well, Mr. Spivak, I'll disagree. We haven't spent billions of dollars there. We spent billions of dollars in Europe, but we haven't in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. I think that, in fact, that it's been...
Well, certainly our war in Korea has cost
us many billions, exception of the war in Korea,
many billions of dollars. I mean, one way or another, we've spent billions of dollars. Have we made many friends there in our effort to save them from communism and sometimes to save them from themselves?
Well, I think that it's generally agreed by everyone who goes there that the United States has few friends. I think that the policy of the government of Siam is perhaps oriented towards us. Pakistan has been very friendly. Israel has been very friendly. But with two or three or four countries like that, except for those, most of the policies of these countries have pursued have been one of neutrality or perhaps a latent hostility towards the policies of the United States.
Well, how do you explain it? Why have we made so few friends when we've tried so hard to help?
Well, I think that there are several explanations. In the first place, nearly all these countries, stretching from Morocco in the Atlantic Ocean to the Philippines on the other side, have been under the domination of Western European powers or the United States in the last 35 years, and some still are, and we are closely tied with those what they consider to be imperialist powers. And as it's a drive against the white race, and we are perhaps the strongest of the countries that might be considered that way to the Asiatics, we have fallen heir to much of the hatred that they incurred by their policy. Secondly, I think our policies have not been too wise since the end of the war. And in the third place, we are a strong power and a rich country, and therefore I think there's a natural animosity that goes with that sort of power, especially when we try to impose our will on these countries.
When you returned from your trip, you made a speech, and in it you said that our representatives abroad, and I quote, were unconscious of the fact that their role was not tennis and cocktails, but the interpretation to a foreign country of the meaning of American life. Well, did you find a great many of our representatives playing tennis all the time and drinking cocktails, or was that just things that happened occasionally?
As I said in that, which you read from that speech, I said that a lot of our representatives are doing an excellent job under very difficult conditions. On the other hand, I think too many of our representatives are, use the words, playing tennis and cocktails. I think, but more basically, that quotation would continue in not knowing the country to which they are accredited, knowing very little of the people, very little of the language and the customs, not really representing what we would like to feel are the representative American types in the Foreign Service. I think that this has been something that's been talked about for 20 years, but I think that it's something that something ought to be done about. I think there's a lot of young men who are very interested in going in the Foreign Service. I don't know where they got a lot of the ones that I saw. Now, I don't want to condemn the Foreign Service outright, because there are a lot of people who are very good and doing a terrific job. But on the other hand, and it's true all the way around the world, and any American who goes there will tell you the same thing, I think that we're not getting the representative, well-rounded type of young man to go into the Foreign Service that we should, as a rule.
Go ahead. Mr. Reston's dying to get in here.
Congressman Kennedy, I don't want to put spin on the ball here, but I was just wondering whether you thought that the Congress, by its criticism of the State Department and the Foreign Service in the past year or two, had encouraged the kind of men that you're thinking about outside to come in.
The criticism directed at the Foreign Service, which has been for quite a long time, and much of it has been irrational, I agree. I'm not talking about communism in the Foreign Service. I saw no evidence of that. What I'm talking about is the type of personnel they get into the Foreign Service. Now, I was up at a college in Massachusetts 2 days ago speaking, and I asked out of 500 students how many would be interested in going in the Foreign Service, and a surprisingly large number raised their hand. What I think is that they're not getting young men who are well-rounded, who are balanced, and who are what we like to think are representative Americans in the Foreign Service. And while I think it may have had some bad effect, these attacks on the State Department, I think some of it they earned. And on the other hand, in addition, I think that they could get men, and they could still get them regardless of the effects of these attacks. There are still a lot of young men who would like to go in the Foreign Service, and there's no reason why they can't get better men than they get.
Mrs. Craig.
Mr. Kennedy, do you approve of the kind of hold-back war we've been fighting in Korea, or do you think we should have fought to win?
Well, by hold-back, would you explain to me, in other words, not following the recommendations of General MacArthur?
Well, he did make recommendations, but others have thought so, too, that we should have fought to win, driven forward, used everything we had.
Well, I think that as a matter of fact, I thought we should have done some of the things that General MacArthur recommended, but I didn't think that we should have bombed into Manchuria. I thought that that would take the chance that General Bradley and others talked about of bringing us into a war with the Soviet Union. Now, what I think has really been our difficulty in Korea is that our weakness in our air strength, and most of the Chinese have been moving their supplies since the truce talks began, as you know, during the night. And we only have, I think, two groups and some marine planes that are doing interdiction along these supply routes and only stopping a fraction of those of the supplies that are moved forward. So that I think we are paying the price for our lack of buildup in our air strength. Whether we should have followed General MacArthur's recommendations, as I say, I would have supported some, perhaps the use of Chiang's troops in Korea, but I wouldn't have supported the bombing in Manchuria at the time he recommended it.
If we could speak of it apart from General MacArthur,
yes.
Our airmen have complained that they could not make full use of the air unless they did bomb in Manchuria the bases of the enemy.
Yes,
would you take
I think
it dispassionately that,
that way? I think that. Of course, that issue has come up again the last 4 months,
yes.
But on the other hand, when we had some hopes of the truce talks working and ending the war in Korea, I don't think that that would have probably been the time to have begun bombing in Manchuria. Once we become convinced that these truce talks are not going to be successful or that they are going to be successful, then I think, of course, we're going to have to reevaluate. But I think it would have been a bad time, even though these truce talks have dragged on while there was some prospect of success, to begin bombing in Manchuria.
Why do you think the Reds offered the truce talks?
Well, there are two views. One, that they wanted a breathing spell to build up their strength, and the other, that they were hard hit and were generally interested in trying to work out some sort of an agreement, which they felt perhaps that they could get more advantage from than we had. I wouldn't be able to tell you which is the correct viewpoint, and I don't think we'll know for another month.
Do you think our men should be asked to fight now to take ground, or are we going to give up in 30 days if the truce line holds?
Well, General Van Fleet and Ridgway are in a better position to say whether these attacks are necessary. I personally, from an amateur point of view, would like to see the lines more or less frozen, but whether he feels that in order to protect the security of the Army we have to keep pressing at the enemy, I'm not in a position to say that, and that's his responsibility.
Why do you approve of our having laid out the truce line before we decided on the other points?
Well, we had to begin. Yes, I do believe that we ought to take agreement where we can get it.
Mr. Lindley.
I'd like to go back to the Middle East and Southeast Asia for a moment. Apart from improving the quality of our foreign service personnel, what should we do in that area to improve the American position generally?
Well, I think that our propaganda in this whole area has been comparatively ineffective, even though I recognize the tremendous problem that we do have. It has been ineffective. The Voice of America really doesn't do a thorough job out there broadcasting. I think most of their programs in Southeast Asia are in English, at least the majority, I believe, are. They are on shortwave radio sets that only a few have, and it doesn't get down among the people. The USIES does a pretty good job, but it only works among a very top small percent, and they really don't have the facilities, so that I think our propaganda is ineffective. Secondly, I believe that our program of technical assistance, in which I believe in very strongly, I don't see any sense in appropriating large sums of money, but it's been very small, only fractions of what we spend in Western Europe. I think we ought to do more of that. We ought to send more people abroad. I think for India, we probably have, you could count them perhaps on both fingers, or maybe we have 20 technical experts working, trying to show them how to increase their agricultural productivity, and I think that we're really not doing enough on that. And I think that's the sort of assistance that will really help. In addition, we've allied ourselves, in the case of Indochina, with the French very closely, which has cost us a tremendous propaganda, has cost us heavily in the eyes of many of the natives.
What do we do in Indochina, then?
Well, we've tied ourselves completely with the French, and after all, the natives are anxious. You can never defeat the communist movement in Indochina until you get the support of the natives, and you won't get the support of the natives as long as they feel that the French are fighting the communists in order to hold their own power there. And I think we shouldn't give them military assistance until the French clearly make an agreement with the natives that at the end of a certain time, when the communists are defeated, that the French will pull out and give this country the right of self-determination and the right to govern themselves. Otherwise, this guerrilla war is just going to spread and grow, and we're going to finally get driven out of Southeast Asia.
One swift question, Mr. Reston.
Well, would you do that, Congressman Kennedy, in other parts of the world? You were in Iran, for example.
Yes,
would you ally yourself there with the nationalistic forces?
Well, I certainly would. It's the only hope. I think we've allied ourselves too closely with the British, and the British were bound to be... after the last year, the British position was hopeless. They haven't got a chance to come back. And we've paid the price for it.
Congressman Kennedy, we have to leave it there. Our time is up. This concludes the latest edition of Meet the Press. Thank you, Congressman Kennedy, for your willingness to meet the press. And now a word about next week's guest.
Tune in next week at the same time when Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated will again present Meet the Press. Our guest will be Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts, who was recently appointed campaign manager for the Draft Eisenhower Movement. Now, good afternoon for Mr. Ernest Lindley, Mrs. May Craig, Mr. James Reston, Mr. Lawrence Spivak, Miss Martha Roundtree, Congressman John Kennedy,